This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will fulfill its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once other signatories live up to their commitments. Unknown gunmen attack a security base in Afghanistan's eastern province of Ghazni. Casualties are reported. And a U.S. judge orders the partial disclosure of murder files of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a move hailed as a victory against, quote, the shameful U.S. cover-up of the killing. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian president says the possible return of the incoming U.S. administration to the 2015 nuclear deal neither needs negotiations nor takes time. Hassan Rouhani said U.S. President-elect Joe Biden can rejoin the agreement by scrapping sanctions with a strike of a pen. Rouhani said that's what outgoing President Donald Trump did when he walked out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. President Rouhani stressed Iran will resume the full implementation of the nuclear deal once all other parties live up to their obligations. He said Iran's reduction of commitments, including the installation of advanced centrifuges at Natanz facility, can be reversed quickly. Political commentator Edward Corrigan joins us now from Ontario with more on that story. Mr. Corrigan, give us your thoughts on the recent comments made by the Iranian president.
Well, I think that the comments are, I think, excellent and important. And from the Iranian point of view, it's very clear. They already have agreement with the Obama administration. They have agreement with European partners, as well as Russia and China. So it's only, as the president says, a stroke of the pen will change the position from Donald Trump's sort of, you know, scaremongering and war in Iran to what is basically the international consensus. And if President Biden, soon to be elected and confirmed, he can simply, you know, throw out the Trump legacy of poison and bring it back and have a constructive engagement and signal a break between his administration and Donald Trump's administration and various policies and shenanigans that he employed to basically disrupt things. He creates chaos, and then out of chaos he seeks some sort of opportunity. But the Iranians are still abiding by the agreement. They've only taken a few small steps, which they are entitled to under Section 24 and 34 of the agreement. And they have, you know, at least lukewarm and you know, vocal support from the Europeans, as well as very strong support from the Russians and Chinese. So yes, I think this is a good opportunity for Biden to break a long string of chain of negative events that Donald Trump created, and to put the Iranian government and the other partners with the CJPOA agreement back up to where they were before Donald Trump, you know, took over and destroyed the agreement. But it was a unilateral action on his part, and of course he still tried to enforce the negative impacts of it by at the same time, you know, having sanctions against Iran, which are very cruel and affecting the country, even with the COVID-19 vaccine. So yes, I think the position is very reasonable and should be taken up, but we'll see how the Zionist lobby and pro-Israel lobby will operate. And of course, Israel just assassinated one of the top Iranian scientists dealing with the nuclear program, which was an attempt for Israel to poison the relationship between you know, the United States and Israel, and to set its own agenda. And unfortunately, we still have a few more weeks of Donald Trump, so there's a possibility that that Israel may attack Iran, or even that the Americans would do so. Pompeo and others would love to go out, you know, swinging and bombing Iran, which of course would be disastrous for the world. But we have to wait and see what other craziness Trump has up his sleeve for the last couple of weeks that he is still in power.
There's also another aspect to this, Mr. Corrigan, and that's the European stance. We've been seeing some ambivalence from the E3, specifically just recently from Germany, stating what the Germans called a mistrust towards Iran. They were talking about renegotiating the JCPOA, including Iran's defense missile program. Where is that coming from?
Well, in my opinion, it's the Trump administration is putting a lot of pressure on its allies and trying to stir up trouble for Iran, for the JCPOA, and so this pressure would come from the United States to the German government. Angela Merkel, who has been, I think, a supporter of this agreement, is soon to step down, so there may be some politics going on between the various contenders for her position, as well as, you know, scaremongering in Germany. But I think it's largely from the Trump administration. And at this point, I wouldn't, you know, put a lot of stock in it, and hopefully the Germans will stay with the French and British counterparts in Russia and China, and we don't have to start all over again.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Corrigan. That was Edward Corrigan, political commentator, joining us from Ontario. Elsewhere, unknown gunmen have attacked a security base in Afghanistan's eastern province of Ghazni, leaving casualties. A security source says clashes are still ongoing. Amin Alami in Kabul tells us more.
This incident happened in Ghazni, the capital city of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to military sources there, two terrorists had planned to launch twin-track bomb blasts on an Afghan army base in Mullah Baba area of this city in southern Afghanistan, but Afghan forces identified them and opened fire on them. As a result, the driver of one of the trucks that was full of explosives were killed, and his truck was also exploded, and the second driver was escaped. Afghan military sources both here in Kabul and in Ghazni province confirmed that at least five Afghan military forces were killed or wounded as a result of this incident that happened in the city of Ghazni.
A report reveals the number of Afghan civilians killed in airstrikes carried out by the U.S. and its allies soared more than threefold in 2019 compared to 2017. According to the Costs of War Project at America's Brown University, the number of civilians killed in U.S.-led raids surged 330% to some 700 last year. This is reportedly the highest figure since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. In 2001, the study attributed the rising figures to the U.S. relaxing its rules of engagement in 2017 and escalating its attacks on Taliban militants. The U.S. military in Afghanistan has rejected the report as one-sided, saying it relies on disputed data that ignores civilian casualties caused by Taliban and Daesh groups. Political commentator Mohammad Daoud Meraki believes the increased bombing of Afghanistan has been Trump's plan, with the objective of forcing the Taliban to surrender and negotiate.
This was, the aim of President Trump to accelerate the bombing campaign and the various raids, night raids and whatnot, in order to force Taliban into a so-called surrender or a military gain on their part. But this is not something unique, I must add. Even though there is an increase in the loss of life, but this process has been going on since 2001. Casualty that the Afghans sustained because of the U.S. bombing throughout the years, they barely report it. Most of the data that they get is basically from sources, relatively official sources. So the number is relatively low compared to the actual number. And the irony is this, that the President Ghani has relaxed all the various rules and regulations that had been implemented by Karzai in his last term in order to reduce civilian casualties. He relaxed them in order to gain U.S.'s favor, and as a result, of course, massive number of casualties.
An alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan has decided to resign from the national and provincial assemblies as part of their campaign to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Kamran Yusuf has more in this report.
leaders of an alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan gathered in Islamabad to decide their future action plan against the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan. The alliance, named Pakistan Democratic Movement, was launched in September this year to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Khan. The alliance, that included mainstream parties such as Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party, claims that Khan came to power through rigged elections in 2018. After their deliberations, they decided to use resignation from national and provincial assemblies to achieve their objective.
By December 31st, opposition lawmakers from provincial and national assemblies will hand in their resignations to their respective party heads.
The ruling Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf has a thin majority in the National Assembly. If opposition parties resign, this may trigger a major political crisis in the country.
Opposition does not want Pakistan to enter an era where institutions are respected and independent, and where there is a level playing field. Tell me, how can the opposition say that the government should go home just because corruption era of opposition has come to an end?
Prime Minister Khan's party came to power after the July 2018 elections. It was the first time government was formed by other than the two mainstream political parties. Khan says opposition parties want to see him go since he is not willing to give them amnesty over the corruption cases. But opposition rejects his claim, saying his two-year rule has only brought disaster to the country, both on the political and economic front.
The anti-government alliance is all set to hold next week a major public rally in Lahore, the political powerhouse of Pakistan. While the opposition insists the government has to go, Prime Minister Imran Khan is adamant he will complete his five-year term. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
A U.S. judge orders the government to partially disclose files related to the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The federal New York judge has given the government 2 weeks to release documents it has withheld from the court and to provide legal justification for their non-disclosure. The human rights group Open Society Justice Initiative has hailed the ruling as a crucial victory in addressing the Donald Trump administration's, quote, shameful cover-up of Khashoggi's killing. The Washington Post columnist was killed and his body dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 2 years ago. The incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the critic's murder. Investigative journalist Max Perry says there have been developments indicating the United States and Saudi Arabia might have colluded in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
The CIA and the administration have seemingly been at odds as to who they believe ordered the killing. You know, Langley has pointed the finger at MBS, while on the other hand, Trump has been very, very deliberately vague as to what the CIA's findings were. And I think that that probably has to do with the fact that we know that it was, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who likely gave bin Salman the intelligence that the U.S. had on Mr. Khashoggi, including his travel logs leading up to the murder. And, it's no coincidence here that in the last few months of the outgoing administration, Kushner has been traveling in the region to the Gulf state kingdoms, including a stop in Riyadh to visit the Crown Prince. It leads one to think, what's going on here? Is he covering his tracks? Did he have a hand personally as a mole? And did he give the Saudis the green light to do this? I think this ruling shows how there are other factors at play going on.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will head to Brussels in an effort to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. Johnson is set to meet European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen later on Wednesday. The meeting follows months of talks deadlocked over several key issues, including fair competition. Johnson has called the current situation tricky. EU officials have urged London to make compromises, saying they will not accept a deal at any price. Both sides have spoken of a no-deal Brexit. If no breakthrough is achieved, the UK left the EU in January. It's now in a transition period that expires at the end of the year. That's also the deadline for reaching a deal on future trade ties. The number of confirmed COVID cases in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 20 million, as the continent is struggling with a second wave of the disease. Germany on Wednesday reported more than 20,000 cases in 24 hours. That brings the country's overall infection tally to over 1.2 million. Germany also confirmed nearly 600 new deaths, bringing its total to almost 20,000. Ukraine the same day registered a record number of daily deaths with 276 new fatalities. The country also recorded more than 12,000 new cases in 24 hours. Europe is the worst affected region by the pandemic. It accounts for 40% of new cases reported worldwide in the past 7 days. Confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. have surpassed the grim milestone of 15 million cases during the deadliest week of the outbreak since April. The seven-day moving average of new cases has also surpassed 200,000 for the first time. The coronavirus outbreak has so far claimed over 286,000 lives in the world's worst-hit country. A record number of more than 100,000 coronavirus patients were also in U.S. hospitals on Monday. The latest figures came as the country struggles to approve the emergency use of a vaccine. U.S. President Donald Trump has come under harsh criticism for his mishandling of the pandemic and downplaying public health measures to halt the spread of the virus. The United States remains in a schizophrenic state more than a month after its disputed presidential vote. They informally observed the election's so-called Safe Harbor Day, but a huge majority of voters for Donald Trump insists the election is not over. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
November 8th was Safe Harbor Day in the United States, when all states were to have resolved any presidential election dispute. But it's clear the political seas remain incredibly stormy. It's difficult to know exactly what is going on because both sides have so many claims, counterclaims, supporters, and detractors. There are reportedly around 1,000 sworn testimonies alleging election irregularities, and yet no election-reversing smoking gun has yet been produced. Many government officials insist there was no vote fraud, but the nation's top intelligence official, the Director of National Intelligence, just said that all issues of election fraud must be investigated, and only then would we see, quote, whether there is a Biden administration.
Traditionally, when Republicans have brought up these complaints about voter fraud, they have been before an election to try to restrict the electorate to the ones they want. And the media, you know, has traditionally gone along with that. That's like fair ball, you know, excluding millions of people from voting is considered like fair. And what Trump's like doing now is by bringing it up afterwards, it's seen as like putting in doubt a peaceful transition in the U.S. And that's what the super rich really care about.
The constant message from corporate media is that the election is over, yet it's clear there is no such finality for scores of millions of American Republicans. Top pollster Gallup just reported that 83% of Republicans believe that challenger Joe Biden's projected win is not accurate, showing how widespread and firmly rooted are the doubts regarding the vote's integrity. In a historic move, Texas and Louisiana announced they are suing the swing states of Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, claiming that they manipulated the coronavirus pandemic as an excuse to unlawfully change their election rules. It appears to be the definitive challenge to the executive orders by some state governors to massively and controversially issue mail-in ballots, even though those orders were not checked and balanced with a state legislative vote. The Electoral College votes on December 14th, but Congress doesn't count the votes until January 6th, meaning election disputes seem likely to continue into next year, regardless of Safe Harbor Day. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. In this episode, you will get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We have said that little is known about his life and times. You also heard that Saifuddin Abu Muhammad Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works of poets and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obeid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen, who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve their worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. Many researchers believe that literature is the idea of a nation, and a society can be known through reviewing the content of its literature. Like many literary figures across the world, Iranian writers and poets have touched upon social issues of their era. Late Dr. Shafi Katkani said, "Literature and literary texts represent the social ups and downs. In other words, they are considered the most important documents of every country." European researchers Volk and Warren maintain that art is a pre-portrayal of nature's engagement with society in a way that a picture of the artist or writer's social realities can be found in art and literature. Poets and writers are impressed by social and political developments of their era. An examination of the works of the poets of Farsi language indicates that they have a lot to say about the developments that have not been mentioned in history. For instance, the writer of the books, History of Iran's Constitutional Period, and 18 Years of Azerbaijan's History, achieved untold stories of the history of the region and its unknown rulers that cannot be found in any document. Literary works are very important for familiarity with the ideas and mentality of the people of a specific era and region. These works are, in fact, unofficial references of history. Seyf Faraghani was an ascetic who felt responsible for the sufferings of his people and tried to mirror them in his works. He was a mystic too. Mystic poetry had existed in the Farsi literature, but once this genre of literature mixed with social pains, it turned into a sore on the head of corrupt and cruel rulers. The poetry of Saif is the same sword and cry. As a matter of fact, dealing with the social problems of people used to exist among Iranian poets, but few poets have mentioned these problems as explicitly and caustically as Saif Farahani. The poetry of Saif Farahani is the poetry of shouting against oppressors. He neither sat idle in the face of the Mongol invaders, nor did he compromise with them. He protested vociferously. His poetry was the voice of the human conscience. That's why his poetry is alive after the passage of over seven centuries. His poetry functions as a beating heart. It is like a history that a truthful writer has authored. It is a clear perspective of the Ilkhanid rule in Iran and Asia Minor. Saif Farahani has left a divan or collection of poetry consisting of 10 to 12,000 lines. His poems can be divided in odds, lyrics, and quatrains. Late Dr. Zabihullah Safa has written an introduction to this book, which includes delicate and precise scientific points on his life and thought. A brief look at his divan shows that he had lofty ideas and believed in social progress, unlike many of his contemporaries. Social responsibility and spiritual values matter for him. Well, dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
The debate.
Hello, and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. A joint statement by EU and UK says that following intensive work, the two sides can now announce their agreement in principle on all issues with regard to the protocol on the two islands. After lots of 10 months, differences still remain on governance, fisheries, and standards. The UK is speaking of removing some controversial clauses from the internal market bill, while the EU has negated any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Are the two sides going to remove the remaining obstacles to a deal on future trade ties within the limited time left? Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Let's first go to our London bureau. Saeed Pourreza is there. Saeed, tell us about the London side of this prolonged, you know, process of discussions and talks.
The agreement today will be removing the controversial clauses out of the internal markets bill. Caused uproar not only in European capitals but also in the U.S. It is being received as welcome news, but is it being treated as a breakthrough into trade talks? Probably not. The honest answer to where these negotiations stand the over trade deal between the UK and the EU is that really no one knows which way these negotiations are going to go. Both sides have painted a gloomy picture of it all. Number 10 saying today that the chances of a deal are not very good. As a matter of fact, most recently, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, and I quote, "You have to be optimistic. You have to believe in the power of sweet reason to get this thing over the line. But it's looking very, very difficult at the moment. The key thing," he said, "is that whatever happens on January 1st, that's the day after the December 31st deadline, things are going to change and people ought to get ready for that change." On the European side, the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, who has been very optimistic all along and has kept things smooth, has been quoted as saying today in a meeting with heads of states that the chances of reaching an agreement with the UK are now very slim. So as you can see, very gloomy on both sides, both parties to these negotiations. Realistically, the only people who know the answer to where things are going, what will happen next, are two people: the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who will be meeting at some point this week. And of course, this comes after a lengthy phone call between the two of them. I think it was yesterday or the day before, that really didn't break the impasse in the negotiations. As you said earlier, what we need to look at again is what's happening on the edges of these negotiations. Perhaps look at the internal politics in the UK. The agreement today between the Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove and his European counterparts, vis-a-vis the internal market bill, perhaps that might send a signal that the UK is willing to compromise, because so far the two sides have been very recalcitrant, if you will, in their positions. The UK not really budging over fisheries and those two other issues, such as the level playing field or state subsidies to businesses, as well as the issue of governance. Those three stumbling blocks still remain in the way of a trade talk. So the UK position seems to be just the same as the EU's. Both sides seem to want a deal, but at the same time, they're not really ready to make any compromises on their positions. And as I say, both sides saying that the chances of a deal don't look very, very good at this point. There is.
Okay, appreciate that. State for Representative London Bureau. Now, joining me in this debate first will be Director of the Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart. Stewart is joining us out of London. Good to have you with us, sir. UK Cabinet UK Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove has expressed delight over reaching an agreement on post-Brexit arrangements for the Irish border. Is this a breakthrough that could facilitate the trade deal eventually?
Your commentator from London was absolutely right. No, it wasn't really a breakthrough. Frankly, this was almost a rather strange, well, it was a very strange action taken by the government previously on this. And in many ways, it was almost set up to try and actually almost annoy the EU in their negotiations, and then to be able to give away on it later in time, to be able to say, well, actually, we've now given something back to you. It's a negotiating ploy. Actually, I don't think that really worked. It just served only to annoy absolutely everybody, and especially the Irish, and also, of course, the Americans as well. And this came up during the presidential election. So I'm afraid, as your commentator said, we're still waiting to see whether there's going to be a final agreement. But as often with European affairs, it's often right at the last minute that something may well be pulled out of the bag.
Well, Justin, the Johnson administration has announced that it will remove law-breaking clauses from the internal market bill. That's been a source of concern for the EU. Would that go through Westminster, you think?
Yes, it would go through. That would actually be approved, because there was a lot of anger, actually, because of it was seen as really the United Kingdom going against international law, being seen to breach an international agreement that it had with the EU. and that would be very bad in terms of reputation. Obviously, that sort of reputation when you're doing international deals, well, as having people going back on their word, no, not their word, on a signed treaty, I'm afraid would be seen as a very bad precedent indeed. And frankly, I think an awful lot of the politicians were seriously embarrassed. This is not the sort of thing you would expect from the United Kingdom government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, also joining us on this debate show will be journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tweedy, out of Plymouth. Good to have you with us, James. Let's have your opinion on this agreement that Michael Gove talked about, and if you think that this could kind of help facilitate the future trade relations and clinching a deal on that front.
Well, what this seems to do is tidy up the withdrawal agreement that was agreed back in 2019, more than a year ago, about a year ago. And it deals with certain disputes that have arisen around Northern Ireland and, you know, the provisions on Northern Ireland. And so that seems to tidy that up. And that, you know, at the very least says that the withdrawal agreement, the original withdrawal agreement, will be maintained. Neither side is going to break it, and neither side is going to pull out of it because the other side has broken some of the provisions on it. So, okay, that's one thing. It doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a deal, because everything I'm reading about this right now says that the EU is still asking for the same things it was 6 months or a year ago, that Britain must continue to abide by rules that it makes, including new rules that it makes. Well, you know, we've already left the EU, but from now on, and that European fishermen should have, almost the same level of access to British fishing waters for a very long period of time, at least 10 years. So that's not going to fly necessarily unless the British government decides to cave in on those issues, which everything they're saying is that they're not going to do that. So, okay, they've said many times they're not going to do that. If they do, then it discredits them. So, it's hard to see where this is going to go. I mean, there are sources who say that actually Michel Barnier is the one who's responsible for this, along with the French government. He was self-isolating for a few days after one of his team tested positive for COVID-19. He couldn't really play much part in the negotiations, even virtually. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU Commission, took over and started to make some concessions, because I think what the Germans, she's German, right? What the Germans want is they want to be able to sell motor cars and other heavy industrial goods in Britain without tariffs. What the French want, well, okay, they make a lot of cars and things too that they export to us, but you know, the kind of lobby of the farmers and the fishermen there is politically more powerful perhaps, and they want to maintain this kind of, you know, they want to keep having that access to our fisheries.
I get back to London. Justin, Boris Johnson hopes, I'm quoting him, the power of sweet reason will allow the UK and EU to reach a post-Brexit trade deal this week. Are you optimistic this is going to happen?
Well, I was optimistic the past few days, but maybe more pessimistic. Well, put it this way, it would be incredibly stupid for the British government not to have a deal. Brexit in its own right is already going to make the country, the economy, smaller anyway over the next few years. And by not having a trade deal, that's going to make it even worse. Now, it's going to actually impact not just on confidence within the United Kingdom itself, but also inward investment confidence. And, of course, one of the key areas that has been ignored on this, really, has been the Japanese car plants, where they assemble Japanese cars in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom was very willing to accept these to be developed. And the deal, particularly with Nissan, was really they saw Britain, the United Kingdom, as a gateway to Europe, not as a destination. And so, therefore, when the threat of Brexit came up, Nissan made it abundantly clear that unless we have exactly the same position we're in now, then the next round of investment in the next series of cars will be going to Barcelona in Spain and not to Sunderland in Northern England. So it remains to be seen that if they don't get that, we don't get that deal coming through, whether the Japanese follow through on that. And although they have said they would invest in Sunderland, actually we also know that there's a backup. They may well reverse that decision. So for Boris Johnson, despite his own political problems with inside his party, with a lot of Brexiteers in there, actually, economically, it will be very difficult and very dangerous for this economy, especially with regard to the key elements of the of our financial areas, which is actually the City of London and financial services, which earns a huge amount of money for the UK economy, whereas, of course, actually fishing, which is very emotional to many people, with people going out and actually risking their lives fishing and such like, but economically is almost irrelevant to the British economy. And so, therefore, they must get a deal, and frankly, the fishermen should not be getting in the way of it.
Now, James, Michel Barnier has stressed on his Twitter page that, quote, access to our market comes with conditions. What conditions is he alluding to?
Well, he's talking about this regulatory alignment where we have to follow the same rules as the EU that they set, but we don't have a say in, and that we shouldn't, and part of some of those rules include that we are not allowed to give any kind of state aid to industry, you know, which could be defined, by a judge. So it could be, you know, almost anything. It could be like the government giving contracts to one company and not another, perhaps. But, you know, certainly it would prevent, you know, it did not prevent the great banking bailout during the credit crunch. It didn't make any objections to that. But it has in the past prevented the British government from saving steel makers in this country, which is quite an important industry, or it used to be. It still is significant in this country. So then we have Bombardier. It's a company which is based in Canada but has operations in Northern Ireland. That has been accused of, the EU has been accused of giving state aid to that, to Bombardier by the US. And then the EU has also accused the US of giving state aid to Boeing, see? So now Bombardier is going to be our responsibility. They make passenger jets. So if we keep, subsidizing them to produce those jets in Northern Ireland, which has got quite a depressed economy, then maybe the EU will say, no, that's not good, can't do that. So this kind of thing. So actually any kind of what you might call a progressive social democratic policy is actually kind of banned by the EU. Lots of those kind of policies are banned by the EU because the government can't intervene in the economy, you see. So these are the problems. I mean, another thing I'm going to say is that, he says, we can't have access to your market unless you follow our rules. Well, okay. The people who voted to leave never actually felt any great benefit from the EU, and actually they felt that they've actually lost things, like many people lost their jobs, because we used to have a much larger car-making industry in this country, and after we joined the EU, a lot of it was shipped to Eastern Europe. The factories moved to Eastern Europe, production of companies like Ford, which was exclusively in Britain and the east of London, moved to Eastern Europe. So, we've lost out because of free trade. So actually, losing free trade with Europe isn't such a bad thing. We trade more with the rest of the world than we do with the EU now, and trade with the rest of the world is growing 10 times faster than trade with the EU. It has been for the last decade. So, the trends are that Europe is not so important. I say Europe, I mean, the European Union, which doesn't include the two most important countries in Europe, which are Russia and the UK, is not that important to us anymore and is becoming less and less important, and the rest of the world is more important.
Now, Justin, the two sides still disagree on issues like fishing rights, business competition rules, and the manner of their implementation. Do you know of any solutions to those issues?
Yes, the fishing rights could actually be put to one side and be dealt with separately, because previously this was already managed by way of licenses which had been issued to various countries and to the fishing industry in those countries. And in fact, the United Kingdom's fishing industry has actually sold their licenses. So this is an issue which has already been dealt with separately and, frankly, is getting in the way of this particular element. And the problem is it's become a very emotional subject, which, of course, the media has picked up on. And, of course, it's always very emotional with sailors going out and catching these fish. But as I said before, it's actually not actually that important. In terms of subsidies overall, it's fascinating because, of course, one government's investment is another country's subsidy. Europe's been having subsidies or investments for years doing this. So it's again, it's a matter of interpretation. Now, what the EU wants to make sure is there isn't going to be any unfair bias in terms of supporting industries. And I suppose that's only going to be to be expected. But you know, Britain does need to be part of the trading unit. As James was just saying, trade elsewhere around the world has been growing. But Britain's largest trading partner in the world is the EU, the largest trading bloc in the world. And in terms of actually the value to us of that, it's very important. But also, don't underestimate the amount of value that actually the UK is to certainly countries like Germany and the export of their cars coming through. But really one of the key elements has been some of the infrastructure which is so vital in Europe, certainly in terms of scientific infrastructure, investment infrastructure and things like that, which Britain will now be missing out on and has already been losing out in terms of some of the jobs and future investment. So any particular deal wouldn't necessarily reverse any of that process, but it still makes sure that the United Kingdom has access to the free market. If you don't have access to that, you immediately start seeing tariff rises, and the operational structure of moving elements without barriers across the not just the English Channel but also across the Irish borders as well, okay, will cause operational difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that's an unnecessary cost, which the United Kingdom does not need.
Okay. Now, James, we have 1 minute only, and this is the last question. Johnson has spoken of difficult talks, but promised there are great options ahead of his country on any view. What is he talking about?
Well, he's being optimistic. He's saying that Britain will, as he's said for years now, that Britain will thrive when it's outside the EU. It will, you know, has opportunities. Certainly Britain can, you know, as being independent of the EU, can sign trade deals with other countries, which it already has done, and it doesn't have to wait for the EU's approval on that. Staying within the EU customs union would have prevented us from doing that, for instance. So, okay, there's that. And I suppose he is still, you know, he's still saying he's optimistic of making a deal, even though essentially all progress has been set back to, okay, to square one. But there it is. What else can I say? I'd just like to answer something that Mr. Stewart said. You know, I should stress that Britain has far higher standards than most European countries when it comes to things like labour standards, food standards, consumer standards, health standards.
Okay.
We're one of the countries with the highest minimum wage. That's why British manufacturing jobs have been offshored into Eastern Europe, for instance.
Okay, we're out of time. Sorry, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, let me thank our guests. We have Director of Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart Stewart, who joined us from London, and journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tootie, out of Plymouth.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the gate of knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you once again to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. As has been our discussion in the previous episodes, we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people. The pious people have been described by Imam Ali alayhi salam in the sermon number 184 very accurately and very realistically, and something that really, if a person were to pay attention and to read properly, can have a very powerful and profound effect in their hearts. One of the qualities that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions here is this statement where he says, "Tarahu khashi'an qalbuh." You will see that a person who is pious, his heart is humble. He is a person whose heart is humble. And this is a very important discussion, because many a times it's possible that a person might be apparently very humble looking, but whose heart is filled with pride and filled with a state of arrogance. And this is very possible. And we shall discuss, inshallah, in this session. An example very clearly is the shaitan, who we know in the Quran, who we know that in the narrations was a very great servant of God, who we know in the narrations was a great slave of God, was a servant of God for a very long period of time, you know, prostrating towards the Lord. But then we see that he slipped and he was not ready to obey. So that shows that his internal state was not in a state of humility.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, it is possible, therefore, as we mentioned in the previous segment, or in the previous segment of this session, we said that a person may be humble from the apparent sense, but his heart may be still filled with pride. That is very possible. He might be arrogant within. And there are many examples. The example of Shaitan that we gave, that he had an internal state of arrogance within him. He felt he's special. He felt he's someone. And therefore the years and years that he worshipped became just futile because of that state of pride. This shows basically that a person can be apparently worshipping God, can be prostrating towards the Lord, but his heart is not in a state of prostration. His heart is still, you can say, having that pride and arrogance. One of the clear other examples that we have are some of the people who express that gentleman culture, as we say. The gentleman culture where they show apparent humility and they show a state of gentlemanness, as they say. But when you see what is in their hearts is just pride. So the apparent moves and the apparent state of showing humility, all of this becomes just fake. And there are different levels of this. And Imam Ali alayhi salam in another narration says, لِيَخْشَعْ لِلَّهِ سُبْحَانَهُ قَلْبُكَ فَمَنْ خَشِعَ قَلْبُهُ خَشِعَتْ جَمِيعُ جَوَارِحِهِ. That Imam Ali alayhi salam says that your heart should be humble towards the Lord. And whoever's heart becomes humble, all his body parts become humble also. But in another part, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam remind us and say, مَا زَادَ خُشُوعُ الْجَسَدِ عَلَى مَا فِي الْقَلْبِ فَهُوَ عِنْدَنَا نِفَاقٌ. Whenever the state of apparent humility exceeds the state of inherent humility, then that is hypocrisy. Inshallah, we will discuss this in the next segment.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we say that the external humility should not be more than the internal, this is very important, because the way humility has to be expressed is supposed to be from inside and then out, not the other way around. Whereby a person shows apparently a state of humility, but he is not humble inside. And this narration that I mentioned is very important here, where the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam has told us that one of the signs of hypocrisy is that a person shows apparent states of humility, but his heart is not humble. Of course, it may happen that a person deeply within his heart wants to be humble, but the only way he can show that humility towards his Lord is through his apparent actions. That way, by showing that apparent humility, he wants to slowly and gradually achieve that inherent state of humility that is there. So for example, a person may not feel like prostrating towards the Lord. He doesn't have that state of humility inside still, because he doesn't know his Lord so well. But still he is told by Allah that you should prostrate. Why? This is because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us slowly, by through this external form of humility, to achieve that internal form of humility. The narration that's right now, the narration that I read, which says that a person whose apparent humility exceeds his inherent humility is a hypocrite, means a person who does not really want to achieve that inherent humility, but he just wants to show that he is very humble. He wants to show apparently without really working towards achieving that inherent humility. It's regarding these types of people. So what we need to work about or work on slowly and gradually is to achieve these inherent states of humility through obedience of Allah and through achieving the right awareness about his greatness and our weakness towards him. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to achieve this state. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد